From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now, and early voting starts tomorrow in Nevada. A new poll from the Las Vegas Review-Journal today shows Bernie Sanders ahead of his Democratic rivals. He's getting support from 25% of voters. Joe Biden has fallen into second place at 18%, followed by Elizabeth Warren and the billionaire Tom Steyer. Meanwhile, there are concerns that counting the vote in the Democratic caucuses there might be just as problematic as it was in Iowa.
I guess you have to say a billionaire in this race instead of the billionaire, because there are two, of course, on the Democratic side. Well, on Twitter this morning, President Trump said he has the legal right to intervene in criminal cases, even after his attorney general urged him to stop tweeting about those cases. Let's bring in our Friday Politics Roundtable today. Rick Klein, political director at ABC News, and Kimberly Atkins, national political correspondent for WBUR. Welcome to both of you. And Kimberly, let me start with you. The president continues to insist it was not a problem for him to tweet about what he felt was a too tough sentence, a recommendation for his friend Roger Stone, who was convicted in the Russia investigation. This has left Attorney General William Barr having to explain whether he reduced the recommended sentence because of pressure from the president. The four prosecutors on the case appear to have quit the case in protest. Here's Barr in an interview with ABC last night.
I'm not going to be bullied or influenced by anybody, and I said at the time, whether it's Congress, newspaper, editorial boards, or the president, I'm going to do what I think is right. And, I cannot do my job here at the department with a constant background commentary that undercuts me.
Kimberly, is any of this going to be a problem for the Trump administration?
I don't think so. I mean, the attorney general said that he is going to do, quote, what I think is right. And every indication so far is what the attorney general thinks is right is exactly what the president wants. It seems that the problem here, given these very public resignations from the prosecutorial team, I'm sure the attorney general is hearing from other prosecutors and others throughout the Justice Department who are really troubled by this. He might be trying to quell an insurrection of sorts and is signaling to the president, look, I'm trying to do my job here. The job is one that you want me to do, and I'm doing what you want. Cut it out with the Twitter, because that's just making it harder for me to manage. It feels more like that than an actual rebuke of the president on any sort of substance.
But it seems like the core issue here is whether the president or the president's friends are above the law. And Rick, there was a story this morning in the New York Times about a Bronx city councilwoman who got pulled over for using her cell phone while driving. She was being given a $50 ticket, then called the department, said, "Don't you know who I am?" They pulled the ticket, and then the officer ended up complaining, and now she has to pay $5,000 because she is not above the law. I wonder, just as you listen to that and think about what's going on here with the president, if she was the president's friend, could the president just call up and say, don't prosecute?
The president has made that very clear. And I think that one thing that rang a bit hollow in what Barr was saying to my colleague Pierre Thomas is this idea that this displayed some sort of independence. We know that the attorney general's actions in this case were extraordinary. Whether or not you believe him when he says that he didn't know what the president was communicating or he wasn't influenced by Twitter, he still stepped in on behalf of the president's friend. He knew the president's opinion on this case and stepped in and overruled very publicly, extraordinarily publicly, his own prosecutors. And I think this was something that a lot of folks who after President Trump's impeachment, were afraid that he would feel emboldened on it. This is when you couple this with the people that he has ousted who were involved in the Ukraine story and the people that testified before Congress. This looks like a president who is flexing new muscles and showing less restraints on his power.
To that point, Kimberly, I mean, isn't the president likely anyways just to pardon Roger Stone?
That's a possibility. He has not ruled that out when asked directly at the White House yesterday if that was an option. So I think to add to the point about the president feeling very free and emboldened to do what he wants to do, this is all a result in part of the impeachment acquittal. The president has yet to be held accountable in any sort of substantive way from any action that he has taken since he has entered the White House. And so you can tell from his Twitter feed where he is taking on every perceived enemy, right down to the actions that he's taken and what he's saying, even in response to Attorney General Barr, that he feels that he can do whatever he wants.
Okay, so Rick, I want to ask you about the 2020 race. race. We got this poll that I mentioned from Nevada today. This is one poll in a state that really doesn't have a lot of polling in the first place. But here's Bernie Sanders again, ahead of Joe Biden, who had been leading pretty consistently in Nevada. What's the state of this race? Do you see one of the moderates dropping out eventually or soon to support another that would stop Bernie Sanders?
What's clear is that Iowa and New Hampshire, while they had their results and Bernie Sanders and Pete Buttigieg had good nights in both states, they actually haven't clarified the race in any way. And in fact, they may have built up other potential challengers for that nod. And the question isn't, is there an anti-Bernie candidate? The issue may be there's more than one or too many right now for Democrats. And I think the emergence of Amy Klobuchar, her breakthrough night in New Hampshire a few days ago, solidifies that and puts her back into contention. I think the fact that Joe Biden and Elizabeth Warren, one-time frontrunners, are still scrambling and trying to break through in some way. And of course, the presence of Michael Bloomberg on the other side, you've got six or seven legitimate candidates, all of whom have the potential to start picking up delegates. You can call someone a frontrunner right now, but I really don't see one at this moment.
What about Mayor Pete, Kimberly? What do you think he's thinking as he goes into this week where he narrowly lost in New Hampshire, but he narrowly won the delegate count in Iowa? And now he's got Michael Bloomberg kind of waiting in the wings to come in and challenge whoever.
Yeah, this is where the campaign for him encounters its first major potential roadblocks, right? You do have candidates like Bloomberg, like Steyer, who can just flood the markets with ads and have unlimited money to spend. You have voters of color, Hispanic voters and black voters in Nevada and South Carolina, who are casting their votes in appreciable ways for the first time. And he's had a tough time so far really breaking into to those communities.
So has Amy Klobuchar, by the way.
Absolutely. So it can take a turn. It's still early, and this is showing how this is very much an open race.
And Rick, what about Michael Bloomberg? He is leading in the polls in Alabama, second in Missouri. Today we learned in one poll he's first in Florida, but he is under fire for his past support of stop and frisk police tactics in New York City. In Houston last night, he apologized again. Listen.
I defended it, looking back, for too long because I didn't understand then the unintended pain it was causing to young black and brown families and their kids. I should have acted sooner and faster to stop it. I didn't, and for that I apologize.
How is he handling this, Rick, and how's his campaign doing?
Well, his campaign has had an extraordinary couple of weeks, in good as well as bad ways. But I think the calculation that his team made was that either Bernie Sanders would be ascendant or Joe Biden would be wounded or there'd be chaos in the party. He pulled it inside straight. All of those things have happened, and that's accelerated the time frame for him to be scrutinized as well as for him to look pretty good in the eyes of some of a whole lot of voters. And I think Democrats are going to cast about a bit to try to figure out how to work this out. A lot of them are afraid of a Bernie Sanders nomination. They're not sold on Pete Buttigieg or Amy Klobuchar as alternatives. And again, the Biden and Warren fades play into this as well. Mayor Pete still has a chance here to be that candidate. But if not, Mayor Mike may be the flavor that people are talking about in a few weeks' time.
Kimberly, one of the most remarkable things to me about Bloomberg is that he hasn't even been on a ballot yet. And yet he is still getting all of this attention. How much does the race change once he's actually a choice that voters can make?
I think that's what we'll have to see. I mean, recall that when Joe Biden got into the race, he had almost all of the black support and he sort of came in as a front runner and then slowly saw that decline. The same thing could happen once voters take a look at Bloomberg, or it might not. They may like him, but voters are just getting their first look at him. They have yet to really render a full opinion. Certainly voters of color, when it comes to issues of things that he said about things that he's done on stop and frisk and said about redlining, I think we'll have to see.
We also haven't seen him on a debate stage, Rick.
No, we haven't. And we might next week. He hasn't qualified quite yet for the debate in Nevada. But how he stacks up, I actually think while his team says they would accept any debate invitation, I don't question that. I actually think the people that want to see him on a debate stage the most are Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. They would love to roast into him. And the questions around his handling of racially sensitive issues like stop and frisk are only the start of it. This is a billionaire. We've heard Bernie Sanders talk about millionaires and billionaires for a long time. He would love to sink his teeth into Mike Bloomberg. And we don't know how he matches up. And until you see that, you really can't know how this race truly stacks up.
You know, there was one more thing I just want to get your thoughts on, Kimberly, and that is regarding Pete Buttigieg's sexual orientation. Conservative talk radio host Rush Limbaugh, who just got the Presidential Medal of Freedom, as you remember, at the State of the Union address, said this week, quote, "How is this going to look? 37-year-old gay guy kissing his husband on stage next to Mr. Man Donald Trump." We should point out, by the way, that Buttigieg is 38, not 37. But anyway, what's been the reaction to that?
Well, look, he currently leads among all delegates so far. Yes, it's just two states. But that has not seemed to be a problem for most of his supporters. And it's a historic moment. Look, you had a very diverse field and it's gotten a lot less diverse. I think that has shown that there is a possibility for someone to break through. And so far, it hasn't held him back.
All right. Well, this race is only getting more interested. We're going to Nevada next.
You're going to Nevada next.
I'm going to Nevada next. I'll be there on Wednesday. And there's a lot to learn. A lot's going to change between now and then. That was Kimberly Atkins, a national political correspondent for WBUR, and Rick Klein, political director at ABC. Thanks to you both, as always.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Finding love at work can be exciting, but mixing the personal and professional can be high risk. This week, NPR's Life Kit is talking tips for love in the workplace. Listen and subscribe to Life Kit.
8 years ago this week, singing legend Whitney Houston drowned in a bathtub in her Beverly Hills hotel room. She was 48 years old. During her life, Houston was one of the best-selling music artists of all time. Here are just a few of her 11 number one hits. Well, behind the scenes, as is often the case, things were not pretty. That side of Houston's life was explored in the 2018 documentary Whitney. In July of that year, I spoke with the film's director, Kevin MacDonald. I started by pointing out that even though Whitney Houston had a glamorous image as the daughter of singer Sissy Houston, her life was anything but glamorous.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that you would imagine having your cousin be Dionne Warwick, who was a huge star, obviously, in the 60s and the 70s. And your mother being one of the greatest backing singers of all time, who sang with everyone from Van Morrison to Elvis to Aretha Franklin, that she would grow up in a very glamorous circumstances. But that's not really the case. She grew up in a very rough part of New York to begin with, and they moved to a slightly more salubrious area called East Orange, which was a kind of racially mixed, I guess, lower middle class suburb. But throughout her early years, she suffered a lot from racially motivated bullying, effectively for not being black enough. And her mother and her sister-in-law recount in the documentary how she would be run home by all these kids from school who would be taunting her for dressing like a little white girl.
Right.
And that kind of theme of being a kind of outsider, even within your own racial group, was something I think that haunted her whole life.
But she had success very early. She got a record contract when she was, 19 years old?
I think that's right. Yeah, I think she was groomed for stardom by her mother and, to a lesser extent, her father. Her mother, as I said, had been this hugely successful background singer, but she had wanted to be a star in her own right, be a solo artist. But she was never able to break through. She released 3 or 4 albums. None of them really worked. And she saw in Whitney somebody who could have the success that she didn't. And so she was, I wouldn't say it goes so far as saying a creation of her mother, but her mother was a Svengali in a way.
And she created this image, Whitney Houston did, of being kind of a pop princess. But her brothers, Michael and Gary, were very honest in your documentary about the fact that they were using drugs when they toured with her, and she was too.
Yeah, I mean, I think they came from a part of Newark which was hit pretty heavily by the crack cocaine epidemic. People used drugs all around them. And Whitney, in the film, you see a family friend of theirs called Keith Kelly, who recounts when he first gave Whitney cocaine when she was 16. And other people, not always in the film, but other people told me that, she was regularly using by the time she was 17, 18. And so even at the point where she was America's sweetheart, when she was this, you know, seemingly beautiful, innocent, fresh-faced singer, and was the kind of girl that, you know, your mum maybe thought that you should go out with, she was actually using drugs very, very heavily. And that just got worse and worse through the 90s and through the 2000s, as people are probably aware.
We have to talk about Whitney Houston's sexuality. One of the people you talked to referred to her as fluid. And many in the film talk about her relationship with Robin Crawford, who was her closest companion during her early success. How would you describe her sexuality?
Well, it's obviously presumptuous in some ways to talk about somebody's sexuality who's not here to describe it themselves.
Right.
But from what I can understand, and obviously I haven't spoken to Robin Crawford. She's very much alive. She didn't want to take part in the film. My feeling is that, you know, Whitney loved who she loved. You know, she didn't differentiate whether you were male or female. It was just if she found herself attracted to you, then she may fall in love with you. But having said that, I don't know of any other documented cases of lesbian relationships that she had, other than the one with Robin Crawford, which went on for a number of years, and I think was a kind of a key relationship for her before she famously married Bobby Brown, the R&B singer.
The most disturbing revelation in your documentary is that Whitney Houston and her brother Gary were molested by their cousin, Dee Dee Warwick. That's the sister of Dionne Warwick. Dee Dee Warwick, also a singer. How sure are you of that? Or is it just hearsay?
Well, I'm pretty sure. I began to suspect that there was some trauma, some abuse in Whitney's background quite early on, just from various things that Whitney said and from the way she behaved. It seemed to line up with some of the things that I knew about the effects of childhood trauma. And then when I was talking to Gary, her brother, about his own addiction, he struggled with drug addiction his whole life. And I was saying to him, what is it with you that you feel, what is the thing underpinning this addiction that makes it hard for you to quit? And he said, well, the biggest thing is that I was abused by a female cousin when I was a boy. And it turned out to be Dee Dee Warwick. So I then went on to talk to Whitney's sister-in-law and to her personal assistant, Mary Jones, about this. And they both said, yes, Whitney had talked to them about it. And the assistant went into some detail about the conversations that she had had with Whitney about it. Now, I think that I don't see any reason why Gary Houston would lie about his own experience of being abused. That would seem quite a far-fetched thing to imagine that somebody would make that up. Plus, knowing Pat Houston and knowing Mary Jones, the assistant, these are very upstanding women. Why on earth would they make that up? I think that I might have thought twice about including the accusation and the name of the perpetrator if it had only been her hearsay. But because I had somebody who was Whitney's brother, Gary Houston, actually saying to me, this happened to me and this is who did it, that felt like that would stand up in a court of law as a pretty convincing piece of evidence.
And Dee Dee Warwick, by the way, is no longer alive.
She is no longer alive. She died, I think, in around 2008.
But Dionne Warwick is. Has she talked to you about this?
No, I did talk to Dionne prior to knowing about this. I did an interview with her, which I didn't use in the film just because it didn't have a place really in the film. And I subsequently have not spoken to her. I've left that to the family. It's a family matter, I think, for them to discuss internally. My understanding is that she's obviously not happy with this information coming out. But the rest of the family are very much supporting the film and supporting the kind of understanding that it gives not just the world, but them as a family of what was really underlying Whitney's tragic life.
Well, one of the most touching clips you have in the film is Whitney Houston singing to her daughter, Bobby Christina, on stage. Here it is.
Bobby, 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 my baby, my little girl, oh, she inspires me, and she giving me joy, 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 joy.
She inspires me. She's giving me joy. But, you know, the tale that you tell is one of a mother who basically ended up neglecting her daughter, bringing her on tour with her maybe, but not spending a lot of time thinking about her.
Yeah, I don't know if she didn't spend a lot of time thinking about her. But yes, it's the hard thing to understand about Whitney. When you're trying to make a film, you're trying to find a way to love your subject, and you want your audience to love your subject. But while making this movie, there was always one point where I found that my sympathy and my compassion failed, and that was when looking at the sequences to do with her daughter. And there's no doubt that she was not a great mother. She was a bad mother, probably. I would go so far as to say. And I think that led directly to her daughter's early demise. Her daughter died 2 years after right. Whitney did, under spookily strange circumstances, drowning or half drowning in a bathtub while under the influence of drugs. So yeah, that's a real struggle, but it's part of what makes Whitney so complex and interesting. And the thing I found with this film, unlike anything else I've ever done, is that people want to debate and discuss it. There are no hard and fast answers, but Whitney's life story seems to be one that is so resonant for people. It's a pure tragedy in the Greek or the Shakespearean sense. It's about somebody who had it all, who had beauty, who had incredible talent, talent without compare, success, everything, and somehow through the character flaws or the experiences of her childhood, managed to throw it all away and ended up in an almost unbearably sad situation.
That is Kevin MacDonald, director of the documentary film Whitney, about the life of singer Whitney Houston. He was talking with me in July 2018. The film is now on DVD and streaming on YouTube, Google Play, Hulu, and Amazon Prime. And the film also features one of Houston's proudest moments, singing the national anthem during the 1991 Super Bowl.
Whose broad stripes and bright stars?
The amazing thing is she had only heard that version one time before she performed it. Whitney Houston died 8 years ago this week at the age of 48. And now for a story about public radio in Colombia, where a half-century-old guerrilla war ended in 2016. As part of the peace treaty, the government agreed to set up a radio network run by former rebels and war victims. But as John Otis reports, this leg of the peace process is on shaky ground.
I'm speaking with Monica Cordova, who spent 18 years in the Colombian guerrilla group known as the FARC. But rather than fighting, she worked for a clandestine rebel radio station called Voz de la Resistencia, or Voice of the Resistance. This is what it sounded like. Cordova helped produce music programs, news bulletins, and even radio soap operas, all designed to spread the FARC's message of Marxist revolution. The Colombian military often tried to bomb the station, so Cordova and her fellow guerrilla DJs would retreat through the rugged Andes Mountains, lugging their transmitter, antenna, and gasoline generator.
No tengo ni un rasguñón ni nada.
They always managed to escape, and Cordova says she survived the war without a scratch. When the fighting ended, Cordova figured her radio days were over. But during the peace talks, FARC negotiators demanded a greater presence on Colombia's airwaves. They argued that most people in rural Colombia get their news off the radio. So the government agreed to set up 20 public radio stations in former conflict zones. Besides providing local news, the stations are designed to educate Colombians about the peace accords and encourage reconciliation after a war that killed 220,000 people.
Diana, ¿qué recomendación?
The stations are operated by a mix of local journalists, war victims, and former guerrillas, like Monica Cordova. She now sits before the microphone at a newly opened public radio station in Ituango, a farm town in northern Colombia that was ravaged during the war. And she's gotten used to reporting the news rather than guerrilla propaganda.
La noticia tiene que ser muy imparcial. no recargarse hacia un lado.
The news has to be impartial, Córdoba says. You can't take sides. When I visited, Córdoba was working side by side with María Eugenia Durango.
En el evento que reunió a los 125 alcaldes,
amid intense combat between the army and the guerrillas, Durango and her family were forced to flee Ituango. But she agreed to share a broadcast booth with Córdoba, the former rebel.
Que me dé la posibilidad también de estar con una persona ex-FARC.
For me to work together with someone who used to be in the guerrillas is proof that Colombians can come together in spite of everything that has happened.
Some Ituango residents, like furniture salesman Adolfo Trujillo, welcome the presence of former rebels on the radio.
Ellos también saben de los problemas de todas las regiones y que está bien que participen.
They know about the problems in rural areas, he says. Still, Colombia's public radio experiment has hit snags. So far, the government has built just 2 of the promised 20 stations. In areas like Ituango, peace remains elusive. Violent drug trafficking gangs have moved into areas once controlled by the guerrillas. And in fact, the day after I spoke with Durango, she received a death threat from one of these gangs. She no longer works at the radio station because she's fled for her safety. For NPR News, I'm John Otis in Ituango, Colombia.
Politicians have been speaking out about the high cost of prescription drugs in the U.S. Politicians like Democratic Senators Amy Klobuchar and Elizabeth Warren, and the man they want to unseat, President Trump.
If you have trouble figuring out if you're going to fill your refrigerator or fill your prescription drug, I know you, and I will fight for you.
On day one, I will defend the Affordable Care Act, and I will use march-in orders to reduce the cost of commonly used prescription drugs.
I'm calling for bipartisan legislation that achieves the goal of dramatically lowering prescription drug prices. Get a bill on my desk, and I will sign it into law immediately.
But Washington has been unable to solve this problem, so some states, like Utah, have taken the matter into their own hands. A few state employees are going to Canada and Mexico to buy their medication at a steep discount. The state's insurance program for public employees pays for the travel and gives the workers a $500 bonus for their trouble. Joining us now is Chet Loftus, Managing Director of Utah's Public Employees Health Program. Chet, welcome.
Thank you, Peter. Good to be with you.
And can you give me an example of how your program works for the state employees who are using it?
Yeah, there are certain drugs that cost an awful lot of money. We're talking about $50,000 for a year. And in those situations, the variance between the cost of the drug here in the United States and what's available either in Canada or Mexico is such that it makes economic sense for us to be able to send them to those locations. The one is in Tijuana through San Diego. The other one is in Vancouver. We give them the $500 cash back to participate, and then we pay for all the travel and whatnot. We make sure everything works out just really smooth.
An escort will take you from the border to the hospital where you will end up getting these drugs that you need.
That's correct.
And
that's
just a handful of people are doing it.
Yeah. Well, there's only a handful of people that are eligible for the program, and the program is still relatively new. We've been doing it for about a year now. There's about 400 people in our total pool of people that we cover. We cover both state and other public employees here in Utah. We cover about 160,000 people, and there's probably 1 in 400 that are eligible for this travel.
I'm just trying to understand what kind of drugs these are. I mean, these must be serious, heavy-duty drugs. Yeah. It's not like just if you have a cold or something like that.
No, they're specialty drugs. Biologics is what we call them. They deal with rheumatoid arthritis, MS, and other conditions like that.
Now, it's very common. Over the years, we've heard many times, or I've personally heard many times, stories of people crossing the border to go either, you know, get a dental procedure done or to pick up a prescription. But this is different because you have a state-sponsored insurance program that is encouraging people to do so. How did you get the idea to do it?
Yeah, great question. So medical tourism isn't anything that's new. We had some experience with respect to medical tourism in terms of working with one of our larger employer clients that's a city here in the Utah area. And so we became familiar with what the options were, what the cost structure was, those kinds of things. And then we had a bill passed the Utah legislature a couple years ago. It specifically directed us as the health plan for the state to share savings with employees when they made healthcare decisions that reduce costs. And it causes us to think about the pharmaceutical space where the costs are very, very high, particularly for these kinds of drugs. And so when we thought to ourselves, you know what? You know, we can, rather than just make this available, we can actually add some money into it when there's savings. That's when it all came together for us in terms of seeing how this would work. We only pay on this program through our vendor that we use if somebody goes. And so it's not like we've had to create a constant stream of money to make the program work. It just works as we send people there. And we think it's important to give people choice and, again, to be able to share savings under the legislation that was passed.
Well, that sounds really good. But what do you say to people who maybe have a concern that if you go to Mexico to get your prescription drugs, yeah, that you might not know what you're getting, that you might get a drug that's unsafe because it doesn't go through the same regulatory procedures as it does here in the U.S.?
Yeah. On that piece, you're accurate in terms of it's the same but different. You know, every country has a process for what we call chain of custody. We have the ability to be able to check that chain of custody through our vendor and through ourselves. And so there's a very specific process that it goes through. And the good news for Americans, of course, is that this is a drug that the FDA has approved for these purposes, and it is exactly the same drug.
What do you think it says about the state of healthcare and prescription drug prices in this country that the state of Utah has resorted to sending to people to another country to get their drugs?
Well, I don't know. We're not looking to make any kind of statement from where we're at. Our job is just to try to find opportunities in order to try to reduce costs for both our members and also for the state on pharmaceutical expenses.
So you pay for the flight and you pay this $500 bonus, and even then you're saving money. How much would you say you've saved overall since it started a year ago?
So far, it's been $250,000 or so. And, you know, more importantly for us, I mean, again, to the extent that it gives us opportunities to maybe get better deals here in the United States, you know, that's not a bad outcome either.
That's Chet Loftus, Managing Director of Utah's Public Employees Health Program. Chet, thanks for your time.
Hey, thank you, Peter. Have a great one.
Well, people in the vinyl record business are warning of a global bottleneck in the industry after a fire last week destroyed the Apollo Masters Corporation factory in Banning, California. No one was injured, but Apollo was one of only two companies in the world that makes lacquers. It's a critical component of vinyl production that experts say will now be in short supply. Jessa Zipor Gray is an independent vinyl and audio consultant in Southern California, and she joins us now. Hi, Jessa.
Hello.
And at first glance, like, this looks like a factory fire, right? But it was more than that. Help us understand the significance of what Apollo Masters was doing there.
Well, lacquers are essential to the process of making vinyl records. And with the fire at Apollo, there is now only one supplier of record lacquers in the world, and that's Japanese company MDC. So they are now the only supplier of lacquers in the world, and they are not a high-capacity manufacturer. Hmm. So they will not be picking up any of the slack resulting from the loss of Apollo.
What do those lacquers do?
So a lacquer is used on a lathe, which looks like a giant industrial record player, and a mastering engineer or cutter will cut the audio into that lacquer. That lacquer is then electroplated and used to make stampers to press records.
Hmm. The president of one company that makes records called this fire Vinylgeddon. I mean, what do you think about that? Does it mean something very bad for the production industry?
You know, I don't want to downplay the seriousness of this event. It is very bad. But the consumer should know that this is not a Vinylgeddon or Vinylpocalypse. I've heard both of those thrown around. Record lovers should take heart that vinyl is a resilient format, and the people who make records are not strangers to manufacturing issues. And this was not something that caught people completely off guard. Hmm. The lack of lacquer supplier options has been an important topic of discussion for several years in the industry. And a few companies and individuals had already been looking into how they could solve this issue long before the fire. So the industry is not starting at zero to solve the supply problem. But there will definitely be issues related to this.
Right, because why was it that only two companies were doing this?
Well, you know, everyone talks about the vinyl resurgence, and that's something that happened pretty quickly. So it's almost like repairing a car while you're driving down the highway. You have a lot of demand, and you just keep it rolling. No one was able to address things as it was going, and they were just beginning to settle down and say, hey, we need to build more of this. But they, yeah.
So you disagree with this vinyl Geddon characterization of it, but what does it mean for musicians, record collectors, you know, anyone else who's connected to this business? Are you going to see the price of records go up for a while?
I don't want to speculate about the price of records. I mean, for musicians and labels, there are cutting systems called DMM or direct metal mastering that do not require lacquers. But the issue with that is those machines are not in North America. So the greatest concern I have is that a lot of U.S. and Canadian manufacturers were concerned that labels and artists might take their business to those plants overseas that have DMM machines. And if those labels and artists do that, it is likely that business will permanently be lost for North American manufacturers. So the consumer, I can't speculate on the price they'll be paying. There will likely be delays. But the greatest concern should actually be for the manufacturers right now.
That's Jessa Zipporah Gray. She's an independent vinyl and audio consultant talking to us about this fire in California that destroyed a factory that is a key maker of a product that goes into the records that you listen to. Jessa, thanks so much. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
On October 1st of this year, you will no longer be able to use a regular driver's license to get through airport security for domestic flights. If you use your driver's license in the past, you'll now need what's called a real ID. You'll also need a real ID to enter federal buildings or nuclear power plants. The Real ID mandate came out of a 9/11 Commission recommendation meant to improve security. After some revisions and some pushback deadlines, the law will finally go into effect in October. Joining us now is Jim Gregory from the Transportation Security Administration's Office of Strategic Communications and Public Affairs. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
Okay, so this could be a surprise to some people, even though I know that the government and the media have been talking about this for years now. But let's go through some of the basics. Is a real ID going to be required? Does everyone over 18 have to get one as of October the 1st?
I would recommend anyone over 18 get one, and that's because you never know when you're going to need to fly. A lot of people say, hey, you know, flying may be too expensive, or mainly I drive, and so I don't really need one of those. But, you know, I ask people to think about those times when something happens that causes you to need to fly. And those are the people that I'm most concerned about getting a real ID.
Do you have to be an American citizen to get one?
You do not need to be an American citizen. You need to show lawful status here in the United States. So a green card would be something you could use to get a real ID compliant driver's license.
And what kind of documentation would you need in order to get a real ID?
Well, it varies by state. The federal government doesn't mandate specific documents, but in general, it's proof of legal presence. So that would mean a passport, birth certificate, or a green card. You need a Social Security card. And then generally two documents that show your address, you know, for residency purposes.
And by the way, you can still use your passport if you need to fly, if you have a passport, instead of a real ID even after October 1st, right?
Yeah, no, that's absolutely true. Passports will work. Something that I'm recommending is the passport card. A lot of people may not know about passport cards. They allow for people to go across the land borders or seaport borders. And the thing about them is they fit into your wallet, and they're a lot easier to carry around than a passport.
It has taken a few years for states to be able to offer real IDs. Are they now available in all 50 states?
Not currently. There's two states where they're not available at all right now, and that's Oregon and Oklahoma. They're both planning on having them available this summer. New Jersey is still working through, and they're in the nascent stages of making real IDs available. And there's other states that are having some challenges, but they're all coming on board, and we expect by October 1st or this summer, they'll all 50 be issuing real IDs.
Where can you get them? Is it just the DMV?
Correct. Yeah. So the state issuing driver's license authorities are the ones that will provide real IDs. However, yeah, obviously, the State Department issues passports and passport cards. And so for some of those people that are in states that don't have them available yet, that's what I would recommend.
Is it possible that this deadline is going to be pushed back again beyond October 1st?
I am not seeing any conversations about that in the briefings I'm in. And really, I would not plan on that occurring.
Do you think that enough people know about this? I wonder if I were to walk out onto the street and ask people, do you have your real ID yet? A lot of them would say, what? What's that?
Yeah, you know, I would say that 6 months ago, that would absolutely be the case. We've really been pushing the, you know, getting the word out. And I think a lot more people are becoming aware of this requirement. And that's really my purpose in talking to you, is just to get the word out that it's important that people go and get their real ID as soon as possible. Because as you know, TSA knows a thing or two about long lines, and those lines are going to be getting longer and longer at the DMVs the longer you wait to get your IDs.
And just remind us why people are required as of October 1st to get a real ID. This came out of an act that was passed after 9/11.
Right. So the 9/11 Commission noted that it was too easy for people to obtain driver's licenses that pose a security risk. So along came the 2005 Real ID Act. They established the minimum standards for the issuance of driver's licenses. And it's about improving reliability and accuracy of those documents. It's preventing and deterring terrorists' abilities to evade detection. And what it really does is helps us to know you are who you say you are.
Do you have your real ID?
I actually don't have a real ID compliant driver's license issued to me, but I do possess three different documents that would get me through the security checkpoint. And that is, so I spent 22 years in the Army, so I have a military ID, a retired military identification card. Mm-hmm. I have a passport. And then because I'm an employee of the government, I have a government ID issued by the TSA. The point here is that there are a lot of different identification cards that people can use if they don't get their real ID compliant driver's license. And those are available on our website at tsa.gov/realid. And you can find that list of documents that you might need to get through that security checkpoint come October 1st.
That is Jim Gregory, who is the Acting Administrator of Strategic Communications and Public Affairs at the Transportation Security Administration, talking to us about the real ID, which if you want to fly or go into a federal building or a nuclear power plant, should that interest you, you got to do that by October 1st. Jim Gregory, thank you.
Absolutely. Take care. Thanks.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.
I'm Tanya Mosley. The Watergate scandal started when President Nixon ran for re-election in 1972. Even still, he won by a landslide. This year, for the first time in American history, we have a president seeking a second term after being impeached. We'll talk about all of this with historian Julian Zelizer. That's next time on Here and Now.